This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
When it comes to the medical field, women have come a long way in 50 years. It's no longer surprising to see women as physicians and surgeons. However, the story remains very different when it comes to medical professors.
In our department, as in most departments of most medical schools, the percentage of women decreases with each step up the academic ladder, from assistant to associate and ultimately to full professor.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear about a program at a major U.S. medical school to help groom more women as full professors. Then we'll catch up with Dr. Karen Hitchcock, a longtime co-host of this program, and hear how she's been in the 10 years since she's left us. We'll also spend an academic minute with beer, because we like beer. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. As recently as 150 years ago, and in the grand scheme of things, that's pretty recent, women were forbidden from attending medical school in the U.S. To combat the prevalent gender prejudice of the day, the New England Female Medical College was formed in the 1850s. Fast forward to the 1970s, when women were demanding their equal rights in all facets of society, the number of women graduating from medical schools mushroomed. However, the overwhelming majority of medical professors were, and pretty much still are, men. Now a medical school is starting a professional development group to try and change that in one of its major specialties, pathology. From the podcast JALM Talk, Randy Kay has more.
The involvement of women in science and medicine has been recorded dating back to ancient Egypt and ancient Greece. In the United States in 1849, Elizabeth Blackwell was the first woman to graduate from medical school, and she's often thought of as America's first woman doctor. Yet today, 170 years later, the percentage of full professor faculty who are women in U.S. medical schools is only 22% and 26% within pathology departments. In addition, a recent study of differences in academic physician salaries indicates that women physicians had statistically significant lower salaries than male physicians, including pathologists. Clearly, improving promotion and retention of women in academic medical schools and pathology departments is important. But what can be done to enhance the careers of and improve the chances for success of these women? The November 2018 issue of the Journal of Applied Laboratory Medicine published a special report by Drs. Anne Granowski and Carrie Ann Burnham at the Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis that discussed the formation of a professional development group for women in the pathology department of a major medical school. Today we have Dr. Granowski, who is professor in the departments of pathology and immunology and obstetrics and gynecology, who formed this group in 2012. Welcome, Dr. Granowski. First question, what made you decide to form a professional development group for women within your department?
Well, when I came to Washington University to train in 1993, there were no female faculty in my division of laboratory medicine within the Department of Pathology. By the time I joined the faculty a few years later, there was by then one other female faculty member. Since then, the number of female faculty has grown. However, in our department, as in most departments of most medical schools, the percentage of women decreases with each step up the academic ladder, from assistant to associate and ultimately to full professor. After I reached the rank of full professor, I decided that I wanted to help other women climb the ladder and succeed. There's a terrific quote from Madeleine Albright, the first female U.S. Secretary of State, that there's a, quote, special place in hell for women who don't help other women. And I agree with her sentiment. And so I created a forum for women to meet in a safe and welcoming environment to develop their professional skills. The goal is to learn about gender bias and issues that affect women specifically, and to help women develop skills to advance their career and increase their chances of success.
Thank you. So these are really interesting statistics. So why do you think it is that there are so few female full professors? Is it a pipeline issue?
Well, that's a good question and one that many people ask. It doesn't appear to be a pipeline issue because women represent half of the students in medical schools. And so, for instance, at our institution, women have represented half the medical school class for over 15 years. In addition, according to the Association of American Medical Colleges, women represent approximately 50% of instructor and assistant professor level faculty, but only 37% of associate professor faculty, and as you already mentioned, 22% of full professors. It's clear that there's still a glass ceiling for women in science and medicine. So the problem is multifactorial. Studies have shown that women don't receive the same salary, grant dollars, laboratory space, speaking invitations, or leadership opportunities as men. So this ultimately leads to less women at the top. A recent report from the World Economic Forum indicated that it will take 217 years, according to them, for women to achieve equality in the workplace. I sure hope that this is incorrect. It's going to take everyone working together to increase the number of women at the top of all professions, not just academic medicine.
Wow, 217 years. Wow. So tell us, Dr. Granowski, about the leadership development group that you formed, and what is it that led you to write this paper?
Yeah, well, when the group formed, it was targeted only towards women faculty within our division. And over time, we included our female residents and fellow trainees and expanded to include women from both our anatomical pathology and our clinical pathology divisions. I think we've now reached a really nice balance of attendees at all stages of their career from both of our divisions. The forum covers various topics, articles, books, and invited speakers that span a broad range of professional development subjects. Topics are driven largely by attendee feedback during twice-yearly brainstorming sessions. And over the years, some topics are repeated due to popular demand, such as negotiation, difficult conversations, and unconscious bias. My co-author, Dr. Carrie Ann Burnham, has helped with our program development. After the program was in place for 5 years, we decided to do a survey of attendees in order to get a sense of what topics they found valuable. Well, when Dr. Burnham and I looked at the survey results, we realized that the forum and the content we'd developed could easily be recapitulated at other medical schools and that maybe our data could be of value to others. To our knowledge, this is the first report on the specific content that women find valuable in a professional development program.
So that's why you wrote the paper, to share that information and hopefully develop other groups. Can you tell me more about the survey and some of the interesting things that you found?
Yeah. The perceived value of the forum and its content was evaluated by surveying past and current attendees. So we created a survey using SurveyMonkey.com and sent to 65 women who had been invited to the forum over the five-year period. We received responses from 26 out of 65, so 40% of the women who were surveyed. There were several things that we found particularly interesting. First, we asked, when you first learned of the group, did you think it would be of value? And we were happy to see that 96% responded yes. Well, interestingly, when we asked after attending one or more meetings, did your opinion of the value of such a forum change? And since 96% had responded they already thought it would be of value, we were surprised when 23% responded yes. But in those cases, the responders said the value actually increased after attending.
Wow.
So some of the comments said that there were challenges and perspectives that were discussed in the forum that the attendee hadn't really considered before, and they learned a great deal from the discussions both personally and professionally. The other interesting thing that we found was that the topics that were rated as having the highest perceived value were those that were geared specifically towards women compared to general professional development skills. And we hypothesized that the reason for this was that this was a unique content and programming that was not readily accessible to the members of the group in any other forum.
Those are really interesting things to find. And now, do other institutions have similar professional development programs for women?
Well, I'd be remiss if I didn't give a shout out to Dr. Paula Santrak at the Mayo Clinic. She gave me the idea for this program when she told me about a similar program that they have at Mayo. We asked our survey responders if they were now at another institution, if they had a similar program where they are now. And only 3 responded that they do have a program. So, yes, they do exist, but it doesn't sound like there are many. Although several of our former trainees have talked about developing similar programs at their institutions. So, hopefully, the number will increase.
I hope so, too. I think I know the answer to this, but just officially to wrap up, did you conclude that the forum you created is valuable for women, and why?
Yeah, so it can be a challenge to measure the value of a program like this. But in our survey, 100% of the responders indicated that they found the content valuable to their professional development. We feel that our program gives women the skills and the confidence to succeed. We hope that our paper will inspire others to create similar programs at their institution. I can say that creating and maintaining this group is one of the most rewarding things I've done in my career. And I look forward to the day when we no longer need programs like this because we've achieved parity in academic medicine.
I look forward to that day as well. Thank you so much for joining us today, Doctor.
My pleasure.
That was Dr. Anne Granowski at the Washington University School of Medicine talking about creation of a professional development program for women in a major U.S. medical school pathology department from the November 2018 issue of JAMA.
That report from Randy Kaye, the host of the podcast JAMA Talk, a production of the Journal of Applied Laboratory Medicine. Still to come, we'll catch up with one of the former co-hosts of this program as she accepts a major award. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Sadly, I never got to work with Dr. Karen Hitchcock. In the 90s and 2000s, she was the co-host of The Best of Our Knowledge for about 10 years. During that time, she was the first woman to serve as president of the university at Albany. She later held the same position at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario. Last month, Dr. Hitchcock was one of 3 recipients of the University at Albany Foundation's Citizen Laureate Awards. She spoke with The Best of Our Knowledge's Dave Lucas about that award and her long career as an educator.
The awards were given November 1st at the University at Albany's CEFQ Arena.
Well, I was very honored to be selected for what's known as the Academic Laureate. That's part of the Citizen Laureate award program that the University at Albany Foundation has granted to people in the community for many years. I was very honored to receive the Academic Laureate, given that it recognizes both professional life, research, and teaching, my life in the academy, as well as service to the community.
Currently a special advisor at Park Strategies, Hitchcock was named the 16th and first female president of UAlbany in 1994, leaving for Canada after 10 years to head Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario. After that, it was a return home to Albany. Hitchcock says her UAlbany presidency was a wonderful opportunity.
To be the first female president was a great honor. I was always so impressed with the ability of the community, both within and without the university, to look at what someone's credentials and what their vision might be for the university before other considerations. So it was a challenging time, but a very exciting time, and one filled with the opportunity to make wonderful connections, if you will, for the university.
Hitchcock also served as chair of the Business Higher Education Roundtable.
As I looked at what the needs of the university were, but also all universities across the United States, the need to relate more closely to the community that supported each university was very important. The need for relevance was very important. So we needed to have a very close dialogue with the people that we served, and that was certainly, of course, our students, but also the community, the businesses, the organizations that with the university were looking to enhance the economic growth and vitality of the region. So we put together a group of university presidents as well as CEOs of many of the businesses in the region so we could sit down and have good dialogue about what needs were, where universities could play a part in helping to meet those needs, be it in workforce development or particular research programs. And businesses could appreciate the challenges being faced by higher education during those times. So it was a very fruitful, very rewarding set of relationships which persist to this day.
Hitchcock has served on many boards in the Capital Region and has been a long-time on-air presence at WAMC, including co-hosting The Best of Our Knowledge.
Oh, that was a wonderful experience, and I'll always be grateful to our leader, Alan Chartok, for making that happen. It was a wonderful time because it enabled us to address a lot of the issues facing higher education in a format that allowed for input from the community as far as what kinds of things they wanted to hear. I also had the experience of taking that on the road, and we broadcast that from Canada when I was principal of Queen's University in Ontario. That was wonderful. We were able to interview everyone from the main Canadian astronaut to someone who's since won the Nobel Prize.
Hitchcock believes her legacy will inspire unity.
Well, I hope my legacy would be one of communication, one that looks to involve people from multiple sectors to address issues from different points of view, different backgrounds, different contexts, and one where coming together in that way in the form of a team, be it in research, be it in scientific research, or be it in trying to bring the giants to the Capital Region, the nanotechnology initiative, all of that was the result of people from different sectors coming together. So I would hope relationship building, communication would be a part of my legacy.
Hitchcock believes higher ed has become more community-centric since she got started in education and research.
The institutions of higher education have become aware that they really must look to relevance. They must look to the needs of the communities they serve, and they need to be part of the discourse that is informing our political life, our intellectual life, everything from workforce development to the most sophisticated, esoteric, some might say, areas of research. All of that has to be part of the agenda of a vibrant university. It's past the time where simply one can say everyone should go to college, and that defines us. Universities have huge roles to play in advancing knowledge and also in looking to the economic vitality of the regions they serve, looking at the quality of life. They have to be more expansive in their mission, and that's a change. Universities many, many years ago certainly were ivory towers, but they're not any longer. They're doing a wonderful job, I think, in most cases, to relate to their constituencies.
Hitchcock, suffering from an undisclosed illness, understands her time is limited.
I'm receiving treatment right now, and am very optimistic and looking to remain an active part of the various groups I'm honored to serve on in the Capital Region. So it's going forward, full speed ahead.
Could a memoir be in the works? Hitchcock says it's not off the table.
Well, I think basically that I'm really extremely blessed to have been part of higher education. As I said at the awards ceremony, this is a mission where I've been associated with organizations that really have one strong calling, and that's to make everyone associated with it better for that association. It's a place where people come, and our role is a simple one, very difficult one, but a very straightforward one, and that's so that everyone can fulfill their potential. And that's an honor, and it's been a thrill all my life to be part of an organization whose mission is to try to assist everyone in making the most of their talents.
Dr. Karen Hitchcock was the first woman to serve as president of the University at Albany and Queen's University in Ontario. She also put in about 10 years as co-host of this radio program. She spoke with the best of our knowledge's Dave Lucas. Have you gotten tired of people complaining about how bland American beer is yet? Well, if not, you're in luck, because that's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Ready to belly up to the bar for another bland beer? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Ranjit Digg, professor in the Department of Economics at SUNY Oswego, explores how the effects of prohibition are still being felt today.
Americans drink bland beer. The dominant American beer is the adjunct pilsner, a pale lager with moderate alcohol content, minimal hops and malt, and corn or rice added for extra smoothness. How did it get that way? The short answer is that the temperance movement was uncommonly strong in America. By the time German beer became big in the U.S., around 1850, temperance reformers here had already succeeded in dramatically reducing consumption of everything else. They expanded their sights to include beer. They also got more ambitious, moving away from voluntary temperance pledges to prohibition. Brewers argued that beer was a temperance beverage, just as it was commonly viewed in Europe. Not an easy case to make, perhaps, but easier if the beer was light, clear, and mild. And so light pilsners overtook dark lagers, and even blander adjunct pilsners overtook them. By the eve of World War I, pilsners were about 85% of the market. The war brought prohibition to much of the world. America's prohibition was uncommonly long and included beer. Estimates suggest that prohibition did little to curb wine or spirits consumption, but that beer consumption plummeted. When prohibition ended, brewers said consumers' tastes had become blander. American beers got increasingly watery as hops and malt content drifted downward for decades. What about the so-called craft beer revolution of today? Bud Light still outsells all craft beers combined, even though craft breweries number in the thousands. In America as a whole, bland beer is still king.
That was Ranjit Digg of SUNY Oswego. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.